elf was standing there, his belly pushing out over his belt. He waved Arnie inside impatiently. I turned my car around, parked it facing out, and went inside myself. The interior was huge, vault-like, and terribly silent at the end of the day. There were as many as 5 dozen slant parking stalls, each equipped with its own bolted-down toolbox for do-it-yourselfers who had ailing cars but no tools. The ceiling overhead was high and crossed with naked, gantry-like beams. Signs were plastered everywhere. All tools must be inspected before you leave, and make appointment for lift time in advance, and motor manuals on first-come, first-served basis, and no profanity or swearing will be tolerated. Dozens of others. Everywhere you turned, one seemed to jump right out at you. A big sign man was Will Darnell. "Stall 20! Stall 20!" Darnell yelled at Arnie in his irritable, wheezy voice. "Get it over there and shut it off before we all choke!" We all seemed to be a group of men at an oversized card table in the far corner. Poker chips, cards, and bottles of beer were scattered across the table. They were looking at Arnie's new acquisition with varying expressions of disgust and amusement. Arnie drove across to stall 20, parked it, and shut it off. Blue exhaust drifted in the huge, cavernous space. Darnell turned to me. He was wearing a sail-like white shirt and brown khaki pants. Great rolls of fat bulged out his neck and hung in dewlaps from below his chin.
"Kiddo," he said in that same wheezing voice, "if you sold him that piece of shit, you ought to be ashamed of yourself."
I didn't sell it to him. For some absurd reason, I felt I had to justify myself before this fat slob in a way I wouldn't have done before my own father. I tried to talk him out of it.
"You should have talked harder."
He walked across to where Arnie was getting out of his car. He slammed the door. Rust flaked down from the rocker panel on that side in a fine red shower. Asthma or no asthma, Darnell walked with the graceful, almost feminine movements of a man who has been fat for a long time and sees a long future of fathood ahead of him. And he was yelling at Arnie before Arnie even got turned around, asthma or not. I guess you could say he was a man who hadn't let his infirmities get him down. Like the kids in the smoking area at school. Like Ralph on Basin Drive. Like Buddy Repperton. We'll be talking about him all too soon, I'm afraid. He had taken an instant dislike to Arnie. It was a case of hate at first sight.
"Okay, that's the last time you run that mechanical asshole in here without the exhaust hose," he yelled. "I catch you doing it. You're out, you understand?"
"Yes?" Arnie looked small and tired and whipped. Whatever wild energy had carried him this far was gone now. It broke my heart a little to see him looking that way. Darnell didn't let him get any further.
"You want an exhaust hose? That's $2.50 an hour if you reserve in advance. And I'm telling you something else right now. And you want to take it to heart, my young friend. I don't take any shit from you kids. I don't have to. This place is for working guys that gotta keep their cars running so they can put bread on the table. Not for rich college kids who want to go out dragging on the orange belt. I don't allow no smoking in here. If you want a butt, you go outside in the junkyard."
"I don't
Don't interrupt me, son. Don't interrupt me, and don't get smart," Darnell said.
Now he was standing in front of Arnie. Being both taller and wider, he blotted my friend out entirely. I began to get angry again. I could actually feel my body moan in protest at the yo-yo string my emotions had been on ever since we pulled up to LeBay's house and saw that the damn car wasn't on the lawn anymore. Kids are a downtrodden class. After a few years, you learn to do your own version of an Uncle Tom routine on kid haters like Will Darnell. "Yes, sir. No, sir. Okay, you bet." But Jesus, he was laying it on thick. I suddenly grabbed Darnell's arm. "Sir?" He swung around on me. I find that the more I dislike adults, the more apt I am to call them sir.
"What?"
"Those men over there are smoking. You better tell them to stop." I pointed to the guys at the poker table. They had dealt out a fresh hand. Smoke hung over the table in a blue haze. Darnell looked at them, then back at me. His face was very solemn.
"You trying to help your buddy right out of here, Junior?"
"No," I said. "Sir."
"Then shut your pie hole."
He turned back to Arnie and put his meaty hands on his wide, well-padded hips.
"I know a creep when I see one," he said, "and I think I'm looking at one right now. You're on probation, kid. You screw around with me just one time, and it don't matter how much you paid up front, I'll put you out on your ass."
Dull fury went up from my stomach to my head and made it throb. Inside, I begged Arnie to tell this fat fuck to bore it and stroke it and then drive it straight up his old tan track just as fast and as far as it would go. Of course, then Darnell's poker buddies would get into it, and we'd both probably end this enchanting evening at the emergency room of Libertyville Community Hospital, getting our heads stitched up. But it would almost be worth it. "Arnie," I begged inside, "tell him to shove it and let's get out of here. Stand up to him, Arnie. Don't let him pull this shit on you. Don't be a loser, Arnie. If you can stand up to your mother, you can stand up to this happy asshole. Just this once. Don't be a loser." Arnie stood silent for a long time, his head down. And then he said, "Yes, sir." The word was so low it was nearly inaudible. It sounded as if he was choking on it.
"What did you say?"
Arnie looked up. His face was deadly pale. His eyes were swimming with tears. I couldn't look at that. It hurt me too bad to look at that. I turned away. The poker players had suspended their game to watch developments over at stall 20. "I said, yes, sir," Arnie said in a trembling voice. It was as if he had just signed his name to some terrible confession. I looked at the car again, the 58 Plymouth, sitting in here when it should have been out back in the junkyard with the rest of Darnell's rotten plugs, and I hated it all over again for what it was doing to Arnie.
"All right, get out of here," Darnell said. "We're closed."
Arnie stumbled away blindly. He would have walked right into a stack of old bald tires if I hadn't grabbed his arm and steered him away. Darnell went back the other way to the poker table. When he got there, he said something to the others in his wheezy voice. They all roared laughter.
"I'm all right, Dennis,"
Arnie said, as if I had asked him. His teeth were locked together, and his chest was heaving in quick, shallow breaths.
"I'm all right. Let go of me. I'm all right. I'm okay."
I let go of his arm. We walked across to the door, and Darnell hollered at us.
"And you ain't gonna bring your hoodlum friends in here, or you're out."
One of the others chimed, "And leave your dope at home." Arnie cringed. He was my friend, but I hated him when he cringed that way. We escaped into the cool darkness. The door rattled down behind us. And that's how we got Christine to Darnell's garage. Some great time, huh? Chapter 6. Outside. We got into my car and I drove out of the yard. Somehow it had gotten around at past 9 o'clock. How the time flies when you're having fun. A half moon stood out in the sky. That and the orange lights and the acres of parking lot at the Monroeville Mall took care of any wishing stars there might have been. We drove the first 2 or 3 blocks in utter silence. And then Arnie suddenly burst into a fury of weeping. I thought he might cry, but the force of this frightened me. I pulled over immediately. "Arnie," I gave up right there. He was going to do it until it was done. The tears and the sobs came in a shrill, bitter flood, and they came without restraint. Arnie had used up his quota of restraint for the day. At first it seemed to be nothing but reaction. I felt the same sort of thing myself, only mine had gone to my head, making it ache like a rotted tooth, and to my stomach, which was sickly clenched up. So, yeah, at first I thought it was nothing but a reaction sort of thing, a spontaneous release. And maybe at first it was. But after a minute or two, I realized it was a lot more than that. It went a lot deeper than that. And I began to get words out of the sounds he was making. Just a few at first. Then, strings of them.
"I'll get them,"
he shouted thickly through the sobs.
I'll get those fucking sons of bitches. I'll get them, Dennis. I'll make them sorry. I'll make those fuckers eat it. Eat it. Eat it.
Stop it, I said, scared. Arnie, quit it. But he wouldn't quit it. He began to slam his fist down on the padded dashboard of my Duster, hard enough to make marks.
I'll get them. You see if I don't.
In the dim glow of the moon and a nearby streetlight, his face looked ravaged and hag-like. He was like a stranger to me then. He was off walking in whatever cold places of the universe a fun-loving god reserves for people like him. I didn't know him. I didn't want to know him. I could only sit there helplessly and hope that the Arnie I did know would come back. After a while, he did. The hysterical words disappeared into sobs again. The hate was gone, and he was only crying. It was a deep, bawling, bewildered sound. I sat there behind the wheel of my car, not sure what I should do, wishing I was someplace else, any place else, trying on shoes at Tom McCann's, filling out a credit application in a discount store, standing in front of a pay toilet stall with diarrhea and no dime, any place, man. It didn't have to be Monte Carlo. Mostly, I sat there wishing I was older. Wishing we were both older. But that was a cop-out job. I knew what to do. Reluctantly, not wanting to, I slid across the seat and put my arms around him and held him. I could feel his face, hot and fevered, mashed against my chest. We sat that way for maybe 5 minutes, and then I drove him to his house and dropped him off. After that, I went home myself. Neither of us talked about it later, me holding him like that. No one came along the sidewalk and saw us parked at the curb. I suppose if someone had, we would have looked like a couple of queers. I sat there and held him and loved him the best I could and wondered how come it had to be that I was Arnie Cunningham's only friend. Because right then, believe me, I didn't want to be his friend. Yet somehow, I realized it then, if only dimly, maybe Christine was going to be his friend now too. I wasn't sure if I liked that either, although we had been through the same shit factory on her behalf that long crazy day. When we rolled up to the curb in front of his house, I said, "You gonna be all right, man?" He managed a smile.
"Yeah, I'll be okay."
He looked at me sadly.
"You know, you want to find some other favorite charity. Heart Fund, Cancer Society, something."
Get out of here.
"You know what I mean."
"If you mean you're a wet end, you're not telling me anything I didn't know." The front porch light came on, and both Michael and Regina came flying out, probably to see if it was us or the state police come to inform them that their only chick and child had been run over on the highway.
"Arnold!"
Regina called shrilly.
"Bug out, Dennis," Arnie said, grinning a little more honestly now. "This shit you don't need."
He got out of the car and said dutifully,
"Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad."
"Where have you been?" Michael asked. "You had your mother badly frightened, young man." Arnie was right. I could do without the reunion scene. I glanced back in the rearview mirror just briefly and saw him standing there, looking solitary and vulnerable. And then the two of them enfolded him and began shepherding him back to the $60,000 nest, no doubt turning the full force of all their latest parenting trips on him. Parent effectiveness training, EST, who knows what else. They were so perfectly rational about it, that was the thing. They had played such a large part in what he was, and they were just too motherfucking and fatherfucking rational to see it. I turned the radio on to FM 104, where the Block Party Weekend was continuing, and got Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band singing Still the Same. The serendipity was just a little too hideously perfect, and I dialed away to the Phillies game. The Phillies were losing. That was all right. That was par for the course. Chapter 7. Bad Dreams. When I got home, my dad and my sister were sitting in the kitchen eating brown sugar sandwiches. I started feeling hungry right away and realized I'd never gotten any supper.
"Where you been, boss?"
Elaine asked, hardly looking up from her 16 or cream or tiger beet or whatever it was. She had been calling me boss ever since I discovered Bruce Springsteen the year before and became a fanatic. It was supposed to get under my skin. At 14, Elaine was beginning to leave her childhood behind and to turn into the full-fledged American beauty that she eventually became, tall, dark-haired, and blue-eyed. But in that late summer of 1978, she was the total teenaged crowd animal. She had begun with Donnie and Marie at 9, then had gotten all moony for John Travolta at 11. I made the mistake of calling him John Revolta one day, and she scratched me so badly that I almost needed a stitch in my cheek. I supposed I deserved it, sort of. At 12, she was gone for Sean. Then it was Andy Gibb. Just lately, she had developed more ominous tastes. Heavy metal rockers like Deep Purple, and a new group, Styx. I was helping Arnie get his car squared away, I said, as much to my father as to Ellie. More, really. That creep, Ellie sighed, and turned the page of her magazine. I felt a sudden and amazingly strong urge to rip the magazine out of her hands, tear it in two, and throw the pieces in her face. That went further toward showing me exactly how stressful the day had been than anything else could have done. Elaine doesn't really think Arnie's a creep. She just takes every possible opportunity to get under my skin. But maybe I had heard Arnie called a creep too often over the last few hours. His tears were still drying on the front of my shirt, for Christ's sake. And maybe I felt a little bit creepy myself. "What's Kiss doing these days, dear?" I asked her sweetly. "Written any love letters to Eric Estrada lately?" "Oh, Eric, I die for you. I go into a total cardiac arrest every time I think of your thick, greasy lips squelching down on mine." "You're an animal," she said coldly. "Just an animal. That's all you are."
"And I don't know any better."
"That's right."
She picked up her magazine and her brown sugar sandwich and flounced away into the living room.
"Don't you get that stuff on the floor, Ellie,"
Dad warned her, spoiling her exit a bit. I went to the fridge and rummaged out some bologna and a tomato that didn't look as if it was working. There was also half a package of processed cheese, but wild overindulgence in that shit as a grade schooler had apparently destroyed my craving for it. I settled for a quart of milk to go with my sandwich and opened a can of Campbell's Chunky Beef.
"Did he get it?"
Dad asked me. My dad is a tax consultant for H&R Block. He also does freelance tax work. In the old days, he used to be a full-time accountant for the biggest architectural firm in Pittsburgh, but then he had a heart attack and got out. He's a good man.
"Yeah, he got it." "Still look as bad to you as it did?"
"Worse."
"Where's Mom?"
"Her class," he said. His eyes met mine, and we both almost got the giggles. We immediately looked away in separate directions, ashamed of ourselves. But even being honestly ashamed didn't seem to help much. My mom is 43 and works as a dental hygienist. For a long time, she didn't work at her trade, but after Dad had his heart attack, she went back. 4 years ago, she decided she was an unsung writer. She began to produce poems about flowers and stories about sweet old men in the October of their years. Every now and then she would get grittily realistic and do a story about a young girl who was tempted to take a chance and then decided it would be immeasurably better if she saved it for the marriage bed. This summer, she had signed up for a directed writing course at Horlicks, where Michael and Regina Cunningham taught, you will remember, and was putting all her themes and stories in a book she called Sketches of Love and Beauty. Now you could be saying to yourself, and more power to you if you are, that there is nothing funny about a woman who has managed to hold a job and also to raise her family deciding to try something new, to expand her horizons a little. And of course, you'd be right. Also, you could be saying to yourself that my father and I had every reason to be ashamed of ourselves, that we were nothing more than a couple of male sexist pigs oinking it up in our kitchen. And again, you'd be perfectly right. I won't argue either point, although I will say that if you had been subjected to frequent oral readings from Sketches of Love and Beauty, as Dad and I, and also Elaine, had been, you might understand the source of the giggles a little better. Well, she was and is a great mom, and I guess she is also a great wife for my father. At least I never heard him complain, and he's never stayed out all night drinking. And all I can say in our defense is that we never laughed to her face, either of us.
That's pretty poor, I know, but at least it's better than nothing. Neither of us would have hurt her like that for the world. I put a hand over my mouth and tried to squeeze the giggles off. Dad appeared to be momentarily choking on his bread and brown sugar. I didn't know what he was thinking of, but what had lodged in my mind was a fairly recent essay titled, Did Jesus Have a Dog? On top of the rest of the day, it was nearly too much. I went to the cabinets over the sink and got a glass for my milk, and when I looked back, my father had himself under control again. That helped me do likewise.
You looked sort of glum when you came in, he said. Is everything all right with Arnie, Dennis?
Arnie's cool, I said, dumping the soup into a saucepan and throwing it on the stove. He just bought a car, and that's a mess, but Arnie's all right. Of course, Arnie wasn't all right, but there are some things you can't bring yourself to tell your dad, no matter how well he's succeeding at the great American job of dadhood.
Sometimes people can't see things until they see them for themselves, he said.
Well, I said, I hope he sees it soon. He's got the car at Darnell's for 20 a week because his folks didn't want him to park it at home.
20 a week? For just a stall? Or a stall and tools?
Just a stall? That's highway robbery.
Yeah,
I said, noticing that my father didn't follow up that judgment with an offer that Arnie could park it at our place.
You want to play a game of cribbage?
I guess so, I said.
Cheer up, Dennis. You can't make other people's mistakes for them.
Yeah, really. We played 3 or 4 games of cribbage, and he beat me every time. He almost always does, unless he's very tired or has had a couple of drinks. That's okay with me, though. The times that I do beat him mean more. We played cribbage, and after a while my mother came in, her color high and her eyes glowing, looking too young to be my mom, her book of stories and sketches clasped to her breasts. She kissed my father, not her usual brush, but a real kiss that made me feel all of a sudden like I should be someplace else. She asked me the same stuff about Arnie and his car, which was fast becoming the biggest topic of conversation around the house since my mother's brother Sid went into bankruptcy and asked my dad for a loan. I went through the same song and dance. Then I went upstairs to bed. My ass was dragging, and it looked to me as if my mom and dad had business of their own to attend to, although that was a topic I never went into all that deeply in my mind, as I'm sure you'll understand. Elaine was in on her bed, listening to the latest KTEL conglomeration of hits. I asked her to turn it down because I was going to bed. She stuck out her tongue at me. No way I allowed that kind of thing. I went in and tickled her until she said she was going to puke. I said, go ahead and puke, it's your bed, and tickled her some more. Then she put on her, please don't kid me, Dennis, because this is something terribly important expression, and got all solemn, and asked me if it was really true you could light farts. One of her girlfriends, Carolyn Chambliss, said it was, but Carolyn lied about almost everything. I told her to ask Milton Dodd, her dorky-looking boyfriend. Then Elaine really did get mad and tried to hit me and asked me, why do you always have to be so awful, Dennis? So I told her, yes, it was true you could light farts, and advised her not to try it. And then I gave her a hug, which I rarely did anymore. It made me uncomfortable since she started to get boobs, and so did the tickling, to tell the truth. And then I went to bed. And undressing, I thought, the day didn't end so bad after all. There are people around here who think I'm a human being, and they think Arnie is as well. I'll get him to come over tomorrow or Sunday, and we'll just hang out, watch the Phillies on TV maybe, or play some dumb board game, careers or life, or maybe that old standby Clue, and get rid of the weirdness, get feeling decent again. So I went to bed with everything straight in my mind, and I should have gone right to sleep, but I didn't. Because it wasn't straight, and I knew it. Things get started, and sometimes you don't know what the hell they are. Engines. That's something else about being a teenager. There are all these engines, and somehow you end up with the ignition keys to some of them, and you start them up, but you don't know what the fuck they are or what they're supposed to do. There are clues, but that's all. The drug thing is like that, and the booze thing, and the sex thing, and sometimes other stuff, too. A summer job that generates a new interest, a trip, a course in school. Engines. They give you the keys and some clues, and they say, start it up, see what it'll do. And sometimes what it does is pull you along into a life that's really good and fulfilling, And sometimes what it does is pull you right down the highway to hell and leave you all mangled and bleeding by the roadside. Engines. Big ones. Like the 382s they used to put in those old cars. Like Christine. I lay there in the dark, twisting and turning until the sheet was pulled out and all balled up and messy, and I thought about LeBay saying, "Her name is Christine." And somehow, Arnie had picked up on that. When we were little kids, we had scooters and then bikes, and I named mine, but Arnie never named his. He said names were for dogs and cats and guppies. But that was then, and this was now. Now he was calling that Plymouth Christine. And what was somehow worse, it was always her and she instead of it. I didn't like it, and I didn't know why. And even my own father had spoken of it as if, instead of buying an old junker, Arnie had gotten married. But it wasn't like that, not at all, was it? "Stop the car, Dennis. Go back. I want to look at her again." Simple as that. No consideration at all, and that wasn't like Arnie, who usually thought things out so carefully. His life had made him all too painfully aware of what happened to guys like him when they went off half-cocked and did something, gasp, on impulse. But this time, he'd been like a man who meets a showgirl, indulges in a whirlwind courtship, and ends up with a hangover and a new wife on Monday morning. It had been, well, like love at first sight. "Never mind," I thought. "We'll start over again. Tomorrow, we'll start over. We'll get some perspective on this." And so finally I went to sleep and dreamed. The whining spin of a starter in darkness. Silence. The starter whining again. The engine fired, missed, then caught. An engine running in darkness. Then headlights came on, high beams, old-fashioned twin beams spearing me like a bug on glass. I was standing in the open doorway of Roland D. LeBay's garage, and Christine sat inside, a new Christine, with not a dent or a speck of rust on her. The clean, unblemished windshield darkened to a polarized blue strip at the top. From the radio came the hard, rhythmic sounds of Dale Hawkins doing Susie Q, a voice from a dead age, full of somehow frightening vitality. The motor muttering words of power through dual glass pack mufflers, and somehow I knew there was a Hirsch shifter inside, and fuely headers. The Quaker State oil had just been changed. It was a clean amber color, automotive lifeblood. The wipers suddenly start up, and that's strange because there's no one behind the wheel. The car is empty. "Come on, big guy. Let's go for a ride. Let's cruise." I shake my head. "I don't want to get in there. I'm scared to get in there. I don't want to cruise." And suddenly the engine begins to rev and fall off, rev and fall off. It's a hungry sound, frightening, and each time the engine revs, Christine seems to lunge forward a bit, like a mean dog on a weak leash. And I want to move, but my feet seem nailed to the cracked pavement of the driveway. "Last chance, big guy." And before I can answer, or even think of an answer, there is the terrible scream of rubber kissing off concrete, and Christine lunges out at me, her grill snarling like an open mouth full of chrome teeth, her headlights glaring. I screamed myself awake in the dead darkness of 2 a.m, the sound of my own voice scaring me, the hurried running thud of bare feet coming down the hall scaring me even worse. I had double handfuls of sheet in both hands. I'd pulled the sheet right out. It was all wadded up in the middle of the bed. My body was sweat, slippery. Down the hall, Ellie cried out, "What was that?" in her own terror. My light flooded on, and there was my mom, in a shorty nightgown that showed more than she would have allowed except in the direst of emergencies, and, right behind her, my dad, belting his bathrobe closed over nothing at all.
"Honey, what is it?"
my mom asked me. Her eyes were wide and scared. I couldn't remember the last time she had called me honey like that, when I was 14, 12, 10 maybe? I don't know. "Dennis?" Dad asked. Then Elaine was standing behind and between them, shivering.
"Go back to bed," I said. "It was a dream, that's all. Nothing." "Wow,
Elaine said, shocked into respect by the hour and the occasion.
Must have been a real horror movie. What was it, Dennis?
I dreamed that you married Milton Dodd and then came to live with me, I said.
Don't tease your sister, Mom said. What was it, Dennis?
I don't remember, I said. I was suddenly aware that the sheet was a mess and there was a dark tuft of pubic hair poking out. I rearranged things in a hurry, with guilty thoughts of masturbation, wet dreams, God knows what else shooting through my head, total dislocation. For the first spinning moment or two, I hadn't even been sure if I was big or little. There was only that dark, terrifying, and overmastering image of the car lunging forward a little each time the engine revved, dropping back, lunging forward again, the hood vibrating over the engine bucket, the grill like steel teeth. Last chance, big guy.
Then my mother's hand, cool and dry, was on my forehead, hunting fever.
It's all right, Mom, I said. It was nothing, just a nightmare.
But you don't remember.
No, it's gone now.
I was scared, she said,
and then uttered a shaky little laugh.
I guess you don't know what scared is until one of your kids screams in the dark.
Ah, gross, don't talk about it, Elaine said.
Go back to bed, little one, Dad said, and gave her butt a light swat.
She went, not looking totally happy about it. Maybe once she was over her own initial fright, she was hoping I'd break down and have hysterics. That would have given her a real scoop with the training bra set down at the rec program in the morning.
You really okay? My mother asked. Dennis? Hun?
That word again. Bringing back memories of knees scraped falling out of my red wagon, her face lingering over my bed as it had while I lay in the feverish throes of all those childhood illnesses, mumps, measles, a bout of scarlatina, making me feel absurdly like crying. I had 9 inches and 70 pounds on her.
Sure,
I said.
All right, she said. Leave the light on. Sometimes it helps.
And with a final doubtful look at my dad, she went out. I had something to be bemused about, the idea that my mother had ever had a nightmare. One of those things that never occur to you, I guess. Whatever her nightmares were, none of them had ever found their way into sketches of love and beauty.
My dad sat down on the bed. You really don't remember what it was about?
I shook my head.
Must have been bad to make you yell like that, Dennis.
His eyes were on mine, gravely asking if there was something he should know. I almost told him. The car, it was Arnie's goddamn car, Christine the Rust Queen, 20 years old, ugly fucking thing. I almost told him. But then somehow it choked in my throat, almost as if to speak would have been to betray my friend. Good old Arnie, whom a fun-loving god had decided to swat with the ugly stick.
All right, he said,
and kissed my cheek. I could feel his beard, those stiff little bristles that only come out at night. I could smell his sweat and feel his love. I hugged him hard, and he hugged me back. Then they were all gone, and I lay there with the bed table lamp burning, afraid to go back to sleep. I got a book and lay back down, knowing that my folks were lying awake downstairs in their room, wondering if I was in some kind of a mess, or if I had gotten someone else, the cheerleader with the fantastic body, maybe, in some kind of a mess. I decided sleep was an impossibility. I would read until daylight and catch a nap tomorrow afternoon, maybe, during the dull part of the ballgame. And thinking that, I fell asleep, and woke up in the morning with the book lying unopened on the floor beside the bed. Chapter 8. First Changes. I thought Arnie would turn up that Saturday, so I hung around the house, mowed the lawn, cleaned up the garage, even washed all 3 cars. My mother watched all this industry with some amazement and commented over a lunch of hot dogs and green salad that maybe I should have nightmares more often. I didn't want to phone Arnie's house, not after all the unpleasantness I had seen there lately. But when the pregame show came on and he still hadn't shown, I took my courage in my hands and called. Regina answered, and although she was doing a good facsimile of nothing has changed, I thought I detected a new coolness in her voice. It made me feel sad. Her only son had been seduced by a baggy old whore named Christine, and old buddy Dennis must have been an accomplice. Maybe he had even pimped the deal. Arnie wasn't home, she said. He was at Darnell's garage. He had been there since 9 that morning. Oh, I said lamely. Oh, wow, I didn't know that. It sounded like a lie. Even more, it felt like a lie. No, Regina said in that new, cool way. Goodbye, Dennis. The phone was dead in my hand. I looked at it a while and then hung up. Dad was parked in front of the TV in his gross purple Bermudas and his Jesus shoes. A six-pack of Strohs crashed down in the cooler beside him. The Phillies were having a good day, belting the almighty hell out of Atlanta. My mom had gone out to visit one of her classmates. I think they read each other their sketches and poems and got exalted together. Elaine had gone over to her friend Della's house. Our place was quiet. Outside, the sun played tag with a few benign white clouds. Dad gave me a beer, which he does only when he's feeling extraordinarily mellow. But Saturday still felt flat. I kept thinking of Arnie, not watching the Phillies or soaking up the rays, not even mowing the grass over at his house and getting his feet green. Arnie in the oily shadows of Will Darnell's do-it-yourself garage, playing games with that silent, rusting hulk, while men shouted and tools clanged on the cement with that piercing white metal sound, the machine gun drill of pneumatic guns loosening old bolts, Will Darnell's wheezy voice and asthmatic cough. And goddammit, was I jealous? Was that what it was? When the seventh inning came along, I got up and started to go out. Where are you going? My dad asked. Yeah. Just where was I going? Down there? To watch him? Cluck over him? Listen to Will Darnell get on his case? Heading for another dose of misery? Fuck it, Arnie was a big boy now. No place, I said. I found a Twinkie tucked carefully away in the back of the bread box and took it with a certain doleful glee, knowing how pissed Elaine was going to be when she schlepped out during one of the commercials on Saturday Night Live and found it gone. No place at all. I came back into the living room and sat down and cadged another beer off my dad and ate Elaine's Twinkie, and even lapped the cardboard it had been on. We watched Philly finish the job of ruining Atlanta. They root 'em, Denny, I could hear my grandfather, now 5 years dead, saying in his cackly old man's voice, they root 'em good. I didn't think about Arnie Cunningham at all. Hardly at all. He came over on his tacky old three-speed the next afternoon while Elaine and I were playing croquet on the back lawn. Elaine kept accusing me of cheating. She was on one of her rips. Elaine always went on rips when she was getting her period. Elaine was very proud of her period. She had been having one regularly all of 14 months. Hey, Arnie said, ambling around the corner of the house. It's either the creature from the Black Lagoon and the Bride of Frankenstein or Dennis and Allie. What do you say, man? I asked. Grab a mallet. I'm not playing, Elaine said, throwing her mallet down. He cheats even worse than you do. Men. As she stalked off, Arnie said in a trembling, affected voice, that's the first time she ever called me a man, Dennis. He fell to his knees, a look of exalted adoration on his face. I started laughing. He could do it good when he wanted to, Arnie could. That was one of the reasons I liked him as well as I did. And it was a kind of secret thing, you know? I don't think anyone really saw that wit except me. I once heard about some millionaire who had a stolen Rembrandt in his basement where no one but him could see it. I could understand that guy. I don't mean that Arnie was a Rembrandt or even a world-class wit, but I could understand the attraction of knowing about something good, something that was good, but still a secret. We goofed around the croquet course for a while, not really playing, just whopping the Jesus out of each other's balls. Finally, one went through the hedge into the Blackfords' yard, and after I crawled through to get it, neither of us wanted to play anymore. We sat down in the lawn chairs. Pretty soon our cat, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Captain Beefheart's replacement, came creeping out from under the porch, probably hoping to find some cute little chipmunk to murder slowly and nastily. His amber-green eyes glinted in the afternoon light, which was overcast and muted.
"Thought you'd be over for the game yesterday," I said. "It was a good one."
"I was at Darnell's," he said. "I heard it on the radio, though." His voice went up 3 octaves, and he did a very good imitation of my granddad.
"They ruined him! They ruined him, Denny!"
I laughed and nodded. There was something about him that day. Perhaps it was only the light, which was bright enough but still somehow gloomy and spare. Something that looked different. He looked tired, for one thing. There were circles under his eyes. But at the same time, his complexion seemed a trifle better than it had been lately. He'd been drinking a lot of Cokes on the job, knowing he shouldn't, of course, but unable to help succumbing to temptation from time to time. His skin problems tended to go in cycles, as most teenagers do, depending on their moods. Except in Arnie's case, the cycles were usually from bad to worse and back to bad again. Or maybe it was just the light.
"What'd you do on it?" I asked.
"Not much.
Changed the oil.
Look the block over. It's not cracked, Dennis. That's one thing. LeBay or somebody left the drain plug out somewhere along the line, that's all. A lot of the old oil had leaked out. I was lucky not to fry a piston driving it Friday night."
"How'd you get lift time? I thought you had to reserve that in advance."
His eyes shifted away from mine. "No problem there," he said. But there was deception in his voice. "I ran a couple of errands for Mr. Darnell." I opened my mouth to ask what errands, and then I decided I didn't want to hear. Probably the couple of errands boiled down to no more than running around the corner to Shermer's Luncheonette and bringing back coffee and for the regulars, or crating up various used auto parts for later sale. But I didn't want to be involved in the Christine end of Arnie's life, and that included how he was getting along, or not getting along, down at Darnell's garage. And there was something else. A feeling of letting go. I either couldn't define that feeling very well back then, or didn't want to. Now, I guess I'd say it's the way you feel when a friend of yours falls in love and marries a right high-riding, dyed-in-the-wool bitch. You don't like the bitch, and in 99 cases out of 100, the bitch doesn't like you, so you just close the door on that room of your friendship. When the thing is done, you either let go of the subject, or you find your friend letting go of you. Usually with the bitch's enthusiastic approval.
"Let's go to the movies," Arnie said restlessly.
"What's on?"
"Well, there's one of those gross kung fu movies down at the State Twin. How does that sound?"
"Hee-yah!"
He pretended to administer a savage karate kick to Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and Screamin' Jay took off like a shot.
"Sounds pretty good, Bruce Lee."
"Nah, some other guy."
"What's it called?"
"I don't know, Fists of Danger, Flying Hands of Death, or maybe it was Genitals of Fury, I don't know. What do you say? We can come back and tell the gross parts to Ellie and make her puke."
"All right," I said, "if we can still get in for a buck each."
"Yeah, we can until 3.
"Let's go."
We went. It turned out to be a Chuck Norris movie. Not bad at all. And on Monday, we went back to building the interstate extension. I forgot about my dream. Gradually, I realized that I wasn't seeing as much of Arnie as I used to. Again, it was the way you seem to fall out of touch with a guy who's just gotten married. Besides, my thing with the cheerleader began to heat up around then. My thing was heating up all right. More than one night, I brought her home from the submarine races at the drive-in with my balls throbbing so badly I could barely walk. Arnie, meanwhile, was spending most of his evenings at Darnell's.
Chapter 9. Buddy Repperton. Our last full week of work before school started was the week before Labor Day. When I pulled up to Arnie's house to pick him up that morning, he came out with a great big blue-black shiner around one eye and an ugly scrape upside his face.
"What happened to you?"
"I don't want to talk about it," he said sullenly. "I had to talk to my parents about it until I thought I was going to croak." He tossed his lunch pail in back and lapsed into a grim silence that lasted all the way to work. Some of the other guys ribbed him about his shiner, but Arnie just shrugged it off.
I didn't say anything about it on the way home, just played the radio and kept myself to myself. And I might not have heard the story at all if I hadn't been waylaid by this greasy Irish wop named Gino just before we turned off Main Street. Back then, Gino was always waylaying me. He could reach right through a closed car window and do it. Gino's Fine Italian Pizza is on the corner of Main and Basin Drive, and every time I saw that sign with the pizza going up in the air and all the eyes dotted with shamrocks, it flashed off and on at night. How funky can you get, am I right? I'd feel the waylaying start again. And tonight, my mother would be in class, which meant a pickup supper at home. The prospect didn't fill me with joy. Neither my dad nor I was much of a cook, and Ellie would burn water. "Let's get a pizza," I said, pulling into Gino's parking lot. "What do you say? A big greasy one that smells like armpits." "Jesus, Dennis, that's gross." "Clean armpits," I amended. "Come on." "No, I'm pretty low on cash," Arnie said listlessly. "I'll buy. You can even have those horrible fucking anchovies on your half. What do you say?"
"Dennis, I really don't..."
"And a Pepsi," I said.
"Pepsi racks my complexion, you know that."
"Yeah, I know. A great big Pepsi, Arnie." His gray eyes gleamed for the first time that day.
"A great big Pepsi?" he echoed. "Think of that. You're mean, Dennis, really."
"Two if you want," I said. It was mean, all right, like offering Hershey bars to the circus fat lady.
"Two," he said, clutching my shoulder. "Two Pepsis, Dennis."
He began to flop around in the seat, clawing at his throat and screaming,
"Two, quick, two, quick."
I was laughing so hard I almost drove into the cinder block wall, and as we got out of the car, I thought, why shouldn't he have a couple of sodas? He sure must have been steering clear of them lately. The slight improvement in his complexion I'd noticed on that overcast Sunday 2 weeks ago was definite now. He still had plenty of bumps and craters, but not so many of them were, pardon me, but I must say it, oozing. He looked better in other ways, too. A summer of road ganging had left him deeply tanned and in better shape than he'd ever been in his life. So I thought he deserved his Pepsi. To the victor goes the spoils. Gino's is run by a wonderful Italian fellow named Pat Donahue. He has a sticker on his cash register which reads, "Irish Mafia," and he serves green beer on St. Patrick's Day. On March 17, you can't get near Gino's, and one of the cuts on the jukebox is Rosemary Clooney singing "When Irish Eyes Are Smiling," and affects a black derby hat, which he usually wears tipped far back on his head. The juke is an old Wurlitzer bubbler, a holdover from the late 40s, and all the records, not just Rosemary Clooney, are on the prehistoric label. It may be the last jukebox in America where you get three plays for a quarter. On the infrequent occasions when I smoke a little dope, it's Gino's I fantasize about. Just walking in there and ordering three loaded pizzas, a quart of Pepsi, and six or seven of Pat Donahue's homemade fudge brownies. Then I imagine just sitting down and scarfing everything up while a steady stream of Beach Boys and Rolling Stones hits pours out of that juke. We went in, ordered up, and sat there watching the three pizza cooks fling the dough into the air and catch it. They were trading such pungent Italian witticisms as, "I seen you at the Shriners dance last night, Howie. Who was that skag your brother was with?" "Oh, huh, that was your sister." I mean, like, how old world can you get? People came in and went out, a lot of them kids from school. Before long, I'd be seeing them in the halls again, and I felt a recurrence of that fierce nostalgia in advance and that same sense of fright. In my head, I could hear the homeroom bell going off, but somehow its long bray sounded like an alarm. "Here we go again, Dennis. Last time. After this year, you gotta learn how to be a grown-up." I could hear locker doors crashing closed. Could hear the steady ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk of linemen hitting the tackling dummies. Could hear Marty Bellerman yelling exuberantly, "My ass in your face, Patterson! Remember that! My ass in your face! It's easier to tell the fucking Bobbsey twins apart!" The dry smell of chalk dust in the classrooms in the math wing. The sound of the typewriters from the big secretarial classrooms on the second floor. Mr. Meacham, the principal, giving the announcements at the end of the day in his dry, fussy voice. Lunch outdoors on the bleachers in good weather. A new crop of freshmen looking dorky and lost. And at the end of it all, you march down the aisle in this big purple bathrobe. And that's it. High school's over. You are released.
on an unsuspecting world.
"Dennis, do you know Buddy Repperton?"
Arnie asked, pulling me out of my reverie. Our pizza had come.
"Buddy who?"
"Repperton."
The name was familiar. I worked on my side of the pizza and tried to put a face with it. After a while, it came. I had had a run-in with him when I was one of the dorky little freshmen. It happened at a mixer dance. The band was taking a break, and I was waiting in the cold drink line to get a soda. Repperton gave me a shove and told me freshmen had to wait until all the upperclassmen got drinks. He had been a sophomore then, a big, hulking, mean sophomore. He had a lantern jaw, a thick clot of greasy black hair, and little eyes set too close together. But those eyes were not entirely stupid. An unpleasant intelligence lurked in them. He was one of those guys who spend their high school time majoring in smoking area. I had advanced the heretical opinion that class seniority didn't mean anything in the refreshment line. Repperton invited me to come outside with him. By then, the cold drink line had broken up and rearranged itself into one of those cautious but eager little circles that so often presage a scuffle. One of the chaperones came along and broke it up. Repperton promised he would get me, but he never did. And that had been my only contact with him, except for seeing his name every now and then on the detention list that circulated to the homerooms at the end of the day. It seemed to me that he'd been dismissed from school a couple of times, too, and when that happened, it was usually a pretty good sign that the guy wasn't in the Young Christian League. I told Arnie about my one experience with Repperton, and he nodded wearily. He touched the shiner, which was now turning a gruesome lemon color.
He was the one.
"Repperton messed up your face?"
"Yeah."
Arnie told me he knew Repperton from the auto shop courses. One of the ironies of Arnie's rather hunted and certainly unhappy school life was that his interests and abilities took him into direct contact with the sort of people who feel it is their appointed duty to kick the stuffing out of the Arnie Cunninghams of this world. When Arnie was a sophomore and taking a course called Engine Fundamentals, which used to be plain old Auto Shop 1 before the school got a whole bunch of vocational training money from the federal government, a kid named Roger Gilman beat the living shit out of him. That's pretty fucking vulgar, I know, but there's just no fancy, elegant way to put it. Gilman just beat the living shit out of Arnie. The beating was bad enough to keep Arnie out of school for a couple of days, and Gilman got a one-week vacation courtesy of the management. Gilman was now in prison on a hijacking charge. Buddy Repperton had been part of Roger Gilman's circle of friends, and had more or less inherited leadership of Gilman's group. For Arnie, going to class in the shop area was like visiting a demilitarized zone. Then, if he got back alive after period 7, he'd run all the way to the other end of the school with his chessboard and men under his arm for a chess club meeting or a game. I remember going to a city chess tourney in Squirrel Hill one day the year before, and seeing something which, to me, symbolized my friend's schizo school life. There he was, hunched gravely over his board in the thick, carved silence, which is mostly what you hear at such affairs. After a long, thoughtful pause, he moved a rook with a hand into which grease and motor oil had been so deeply grimed that not even Boraxo would take it all out. Of course, not all the shoppies were out to get him. There were plenty of good kids down that way, but a lot of them were either into their own tight circles of friends or permanently stoned. The ones in the tight little cliques were usually from the poorer section of Libertyville. And don't ever let anyone tell you high school students aren't tracked according to what part of town they come from. They are. Very serious and so quiet, you might make the mistake of dismissing them as stupid. Most of them look like leftovers from 1968, with their long hair tied back in ponytails, and their jeans, and their tie-dyed t-shirts. But in 1978, none of these guys wanted to overthrow the government. They wanted to grow up to be Mr. Goodwrench. And shop is still the final stopping place for the misfits and hard-asses who aren't so much attending school as they are being incarcerated there. And now that Arnie brought up Repperton's name, I could think of several guys who circled him like a planetary system. Most of them were 20 and still struggling to get out of school. Don Vandenberg, Sandy Galton, Moochie Welch. Moochie's real name was Peter, but the kids all called him Moochie because you always saw him outside of the rock concerts in Pittsburgh, spare changing.
Buddy Repperton had come by a 2-year-old blue Camaro that had been rolled over a couple of times out on Route 46 near Squanic Hill State Park. He picked it up from one of Darnell's poker buddies, Arnie said. The engine was okay, but the body had really taken chong from the tong and the rollover. Repperton brought it into Darnell's about a week after Arnie brought Christine in, although Buddy had been hanging around even before that. For the first couple of days, Repperton hadn't appeared to notice Arnie at all, and Arnie, of course, was just as happy not to be noticed. Repperton was on good terms with Darnell, though. He seemed to have no trouble obtaining high-demand tools that were usually only available on a reserve basis. Then Repperton had started getting on Arnie's case. He'd walk by on his way back from the Coke machine or the bathroom and knock a box full of ball joint wrench attachments that Arnie was using all over the floor in Arnie's stall. Or if Arnie had a coffee on a shelf, Repperton would manage to hit it with his elbow and spill it. Then he'd bugle, "Well, excuse me," like Steve Martin, with this big shit-eating grin on his face. Darnell would holler over for Arnie to pick up those attachments before one of them went down through a drain in the floor or something. Soon Repperton was swerving out of his way to give Arnie a whistling clap on the back, accompanied by a bellowed, "How you doing, cunt face?" Arnie bore these opening salvos with the stoicism of a guy who has seen it all before, been through it all before. He was probably hoping for one of two things. Either that the harassment would reach a constant level of annoyance and stop there, or that Buddy Repperton would find some other victim and move on. There was a third possibility as well, one almost too good to hope for. It was always possible that Buddy would get righteously busted for something and just disappear from the scene, like his old buddy Roger Gilman. It had come to blows on the Saturday afternoon just past. Arnie was doing a grease job on his car, mostly because he hadn't yet accumulated sufficient funds to do any of the 100 other things the car cried out for. Repperton came by, whistling cheerfully, a Coke and a bag of peanuts in one hand, a jack handle in the other. And as he passed stall 20, he whipped the jack handle out sidearm and broke one of Christine's headlights. "Smashed it to shit," Arnie told me over our pizza. "Oh, jeez, look at what I did," Buddy Repperton had said, an exaggerated expression of tragedy on his face. "Well, excuse—" But that was all he got out. The attack on Christine managed what the attacks on Arnie himself hadn't been able to do. It provoked him into retaliation. He came around the side of the Plymouth, hands balled into fists, and struck out blindly. In a book or a movie, he probably would have socked Repperton right on the old knockout button and put him on the floor for a 10-count. Things rarely work out that way in real life. Arnie didn't get anywhere near Repperton's chin. Instead, he hit Repperton's hand, knocked the bag of peanuts on the floor, and spilled Coca-Cola all over Repperton's face and shirt. "All right, you fucking little prick," Repperton cried. He looked almost comically stunned. "There goes your ass." He came for Arnie with the jack handle. Several of the other men ran over then, and one of them told Repperton to drop the jack handle and fight fair. Repperton threw it away and waded in. "Darnell never tried to put a stop to it?" I asked Arnie. "He wasn't there, Dennis. He disappeared 15 minutes or half an hour before it started. It's like he knew it was going to happen." Arnie said that Repperton had done most of the damage right away. The black eye was first, the scrape on his face, made by the class ring Repperton had purchased during one of his many sophomore years, came directly afterward. "Plus assorted other bruises," he said. "What other bruises?" We were sitting in one of the back booths. Arnie glanced around to make sure no one was looking at us, and then raised his T-shirt. I hissed in breath at what I saw. A terrific sunset of bruises, yellow, red, purple, brown, covered Arnie's chest and stomach. They were just starting to fade. How he had been able to come to work after getting mashed around like that, I couldn't begin to understand. "Man, are you sure he didn't spring any of your ribs?" I asked. I was really horrified. The shiner and the scrape looked tame next to this shit. I had seen high school scuffles, of course, had even been in a few, but I was looking at the results of a serious beating for the first time in my life. "Pretty sure," he said levelly.
I was lucky.
I guess you were. Arnie didn't say a lot more, but a kid I knew named Randy Turner was there, and he filled me in on what had happened in more detail after school had started again. He said that Arnie might have gotten hurt a lot worse, but he came back at Buddy a lot harder and a lot madder than Buddy had expected. In fact, Randy said, Arnie went after Buddy Rapperton as if the devil had blown a charge of red pepper up his ass. His arms were windmilling, his fists were everywhere. He was yelling, cursing, spraying spittle. I tried to picture it and couldn't. The picture I kept coming up with instead was Arnie slamming his fists down on my dashboard hard enough to make dents, screaming that he would make them eat it. He drove Rapperton halfway across the garage, bloodied his nose, more by good luck than good aim, and got one to Rapperton's throat that made him start to cough and gag and generally lose interest in busting Arnie Cunningham's ass. Buddy turned away, holding his throat and trying to puke, and Arnie drove one of his steel-toed work boots into Rapperton's jeans-clad butt, knocking him flat on his belly and forearms. Rapperton was still gagging and holding his throat with one hand, his nose was bleeding like mad, and, again, according to Randy Turner, Arnie was apparently gearing up to kick the son of a bitch to death when Will Darnell magically reappeared, hollering in his wheezy voice to cut the shit over there, cut the shit, cut the shit. Arnie thought that fight was going to happen, I told Randy. He thought it was a put-up job. Randy shrugged.
Maybe. Could be. Sure was funny the way Darnell showed up when Rapperton really started to lose.
About seven guys grabbed Arnie and dragged him away. At first he fought them like a wild man, screaming for them to let him go, screaming that if Rapperton didn't pay for the broken headlight, he'd kill him. Then he subsided, bewildered and hardly aware how it had happened that Rapperton was down and he was still on his feet. Rapperton finally got up, his white T-shirt smeared with dirt and grease, his nose still bubbling blood. He made a lunge for Arnie. Randy said it looked like a pretty half-hearted lunge, mostly for form's sake. Some of the other guys got hold of him and led him away. Darnell came over to Arnie and told him to hand in his toolbox key and get out.
Jesus, Arnie, why didn't you call me Saturday afternoon?
He sighed. I was too depressed.
We finished our pizza, and I bought Arnie a third Pepsi. That stuff's murder on your complexion, but it's great for depression.
I don't know if he meant to get out just for Saturday or from then on, Arnie said to me on our way home. What do you think, Dennis? You think he kicked me out for good?
He asked for your toolbox key, you said.
Yeah, he did. I never got kicked out of any place before.
He looked like he was going to cry.
A place bites the root anyway. Will Darnell's an asshole.
I guess it would be stupid to try and keep it there anymore anyway, he said. Even if Darnell lets me come back, Rapperton's there. I'd fight him again.
I started to hum the theme from Rocky.
Yeah, fuck you and a cayuse you rode in on, Range Rider, he said, smiling a little. I really would fight him. But Rapperton might take after her with that jackhandle again when I wasn't there. I don't think Darnell would stop him if he did.
I didn't answer, and maybe Arnie thought that meant I agreed with him. But I didn't. I didn't think his old rust bucket Plymouth Fury was the main target. And if Rapperton felt that he couldn't accomplish the demolition of the main target by himself, he would simply get by with a little help from his friends, Don Vandenberg, Moochie Welch, et al. Get on your motor huckle boots, boys. We got plenty good stomping tonight. It occurred to me that they could kill him. Not just kill him, but really, honest to Christ, kill him. Guys like that sometimes did. Things just went a little too far, and some kid wound up dead. You read about it in the papers sometimes.
Keeper?
Huh? I hadn't followed that. Up ahead, Arnie's house was in view.
I asked if you had any ideas about where I could keep her.
The car, that's all he could talk about. He was starting to sound like a broken record. And worse, it was always her. He was bright enough to see his growing obsession with her, it. But he wasn't picking it up. He wasn't picking it up at all.
Arnie, I said, my man, you've got more important things to worry about than where to keep the car. I want to know where you're going to keep you.
What are you talking about? I'm asking you what you're going to do if Buddy and Buddy's buddies decide they want to put you in traction.
His face suddenly grew wise. It grew wise so suddenly that it was frightening to watch. It was wise and helpless and enduring. It was a face I recognized from the news when I was only 8 or 9 or so. The face of all those soldiers in black pajamas who had kicked the living shit out of the best-equipped and best-supported army in the world.
"Dennis," he said,
"I'll do what I can."
Chapter 10. LeBay Passes. The movie version of Grease had just opened, and I took the cheerleader out to see it that night. I thought it was dumb. The cheerleader loved it. I sat there watching those totally unreal teenagers dance and sing. If I want realistic teenagers, well, more or less, I'll catch the Blackboard Jungle sometime on a revival. And my mind just drifted away. And suddenly, I had a brainstorm, the way you sometimes will when you're not thinking about anything in particular. I excused myself and went into the lobby to use the payphone. I called Arnie's house, dialing quick and sure. I'd had his number memorized since I was 8 or so. I could have waited until the movie was over, but it just seemed like such a damned good idea. Arnie himself answered.
"Hello?
Arnie, it's Dennis."
"Oh, Dennis."
His voice was so odd and flat that I got a little scared. "Arnie, are you all right?"
Sure. I thought you were taking Roseanne to the movies."
"That's where I'm calling from."
"It must not be that exciting," Arnie said.
His voice was still flat, flat and dreary. "Roseanne thinks it's great." I thought that would get a laugh out of him, but there was only a patient, waiting silence. "Listen," I said, "I thought of the answer."
"Answer?"
"Sure," I said. "LeBay. LeBay is the answer."
"Le,"
he said, in a strange, high voice. And then there was more silence. I was starting to get more than a little scared. I'd never known him to be quite this way. "Sure," I babbled. "LeBay. LeBay's got a garage, and I got the idea that he'd eat a dead rat sandwich if the profit margin looked high enough. If you were to approach him on the basis of, say, 16 or 17 bucks a week..."
"Very funny, Dennis."
His voice was cold and hateful. "Arnie, what?" He hung up. I stood there, looking at the phone, wondering what the hell it was about. Some new move from his parents? Or had he maybe gone back to Darnell's and found some new damage to his car, or... A sudden intuition, almost a certainty, struck me. I put the telephone back in its cradle and walked over to the concession stand and asked if they had today's paper. The candy and popcorn girl finally fished it out and then stood there snapping her gum while I thumbed the back where they print the obituaries. I guess she wanted to make sure I wasn't going to perform some weird perversion on it, or maybe eat it. There was nothing at all, or so I thought at first. Then I turned the page and saw the headline. "Libertyville Veteran Dies at 71. There was a picture of Roland D. LeBay in his army uniform, looking 20 years younger and considerably more bright-eyed than he had on the occasions Arnie and I had seen him. The obit was brief. LeBay had died suddenly on Saturday afternoon. He was survived by a brother, George, and a sister, Marcia. Funeral services were scheduled for Tuesday at 2. Suddenly. In the obits, it's always after a long illness, after a short illness, or suddenly. Suddenly can mean anything from a brain embolism to electrocuting yourself in the bathtub. I remembered something I had done to Ellie when she was hardly more than a baby, 3 maybe. I scared the bejesus out of her with a jack-in-the-box. There was the little handle going around and Big Brother Dennis's hand, making music, not bad, kind of fun. And then, kabonzo! Out comes this guy with a grinning face and an ugly hooked nose, almost hitting her in the eye. Ellie went off bawling to find her mother, and I sat there, looking glumly at Jack as he nodded back and forth, knowing I was probably going to get hollered at, knowing that I probably deserved to get hollered at. I had known it was going to scare her, coming out of the music like that, all at once, with an ugly bang, coming out so suddenly. I gave the paper back and stood there,
looking blankly at the posters advertising Next Attraction and Coming Soon. Saturday afternoon. Suddenly. Funny how things sometimes worked out. My brainstorm had been that maybe Arnie could take Christine back where she had come from. Maybe he could pay LeBay for space. Now it turned out that LeBay was dead. He had died, as a matter of fact, on the same day that Arnie had gotten into it with Buddy Repperton, the same day Buddy had smashed Christine's headlight. All at once, I had an irrational picture of Buddy Repperton swinging that jackhandle, and at the exact same moment, LeBay's eye gushes blood. He keels over, and suddenly, very suddenly, "Cut the shit, Dennis," I lectured. "Just cut the..." And then, somewhere deep in my mind, somewhere near the center, a voice whispered, "Come on, big guy, let's cruise." And then fell still. The girl behind the counter popped her gum and said, "You're missing the end of the picture. Ending's the best part." "Yeah, thanks." I started back toward the door of the theater and then detoured to the drinking fountain. My throat was very dry. Before I'd finished getting my drink, the doors opened and people came streaming out. Beyond and above their bobbing heads, I could see the credit roll. Then Roseanne came out, looking around for me. She caught many appreciative glances and fielded them cleanly in that dreamy, composed way of hers. "Den-Den," she said, taking my arm. "Being called Den-Den isn't the worst thing in the world. Having your eyes put out with a hot poker or having a leg amputated with a chainsaw is probably worse. But I've never really dug it all that much."
"Where were you? You missed the ending."
"Ending's the best part," I finished with her. "Sorry. I just had this call in nature. It came on very suddenly."
"I'll tell you all about it if you take me up to the embankment for a while," she said, pressing my arm against the soft side swell of her breast. "If you want to talk, that is."
"Did it have a happy ending?" She smiled up at me, her eyes wide and sweet and a little dazed, as they always were. She held my arm even more tightly against her breast.
"Very happy," she said. "I like happy endings. Don't you, Den-Den?"
"Love 'em," I said. I should maybe have been thinking about the promise of her breast, but instead, I found myself thinking about Arnie. That night I had a dream again. Only in this one Christine was old. No, not just old, she was ancient, a terrible hulk of a car, something you'd expect to see in a tarot deck. Instead of the Hanged Man, the Death Car, something you could almost believe was as old as the pyramids. The engine roared and missed and jetted filthy blue oil smoke. It wasn't empty. Roland D. LeBay was lolling behind the wheel. His eyes were open, but they were glazed and dead. Each time the engine revved and Christine's rust-eaten body vibrated, he flopped like a rag doll. His peeling skull nodded back and forth. Then the tires screamed their terrible scream. The Plymouth lunged out of the garage at me, and as it did, the rust melted away. The old, bleary glass clarified. The chrome winked with savage newness, and the old, balding tires suddenly bloomed into plump, new, wide ovals, each tread seemingly as deep as the Grand Canyon. It screamed at me, headlights glaring white circles of hate, and as I raised my hands in a stupid, useless, warding-off gesture, I thought, "God, it's unending fury." I woke up. I didn't scream. That night, I kept the scream in my throat. Just barely. I sat up in my bed, a cold puddle of moonlight caught in a lap full of sheet, and I thought, died suddenly. That night, I didn't get back to sleep so quickly. Chapter 11. The Funeral. Brad Jeffries, our road crew foreman, was in his mid-40s, balding, stocky, permanently sunburned. He liked to holler a lot, particularly when we were behind schedule, but was a decent enough man. I went to see him during our coffee break to find out if Arnie had asked for part or all of the afternoon off. "He asked for 2 hours so he could go to a burying," Brad said. He took off his steel-rimmed glasses and massaged the red spots they had left on the sides of his nose.
Now don't you ask, I'm losing you both at the end of the week anyway, and all the jerk-offs are staying. Brad, I have to ask. Why, who is this guy? Cunningham said he sold him a car, that's all. Christ, I didn't think anyone went to a used car salesman's funeral except for his family.
It wasn't a used car salesman, it was just a guy. Arnie's having some problems about this, Brad. I feel like I ought to go with him.
Brad sighed. Okay, 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 okay. You can have 1 to 3, just like him, if you'll agree to work through your lunch hour and stay on till 6 Thursday night.
Sure. Thanks, Brad.
I'll punch you out just like regular, Brad said. And if anybody at Penn DOT in Pittsburgh finds out about this, my ass is going to be grass. They won't. Gonna be sorry to lose you guys, he said. He picked up the paper and shook it out to the sports. Coming from Brad, that was high praise.
It's been a good summer for us, too.
I'm glad you feel that way, Dennis. Now get out of here and let me read the paper.
I did.
At 1 o'clock, I caught a ride up to the main construction shed on a grader. Arnie was inside, hanging up his yellow hard hat and putting on a clean shirt. He looked at me, startled.
Dennis, what are you doing here?
Getting ready to go to a funeral, I said. Same as you.
No,
he said immediately. And it was more that word than anything else. The Saturdays he was no longer there. The coolness of Michael and Regina over the phone. The way he had been when I called him from the movies. It made me realize how much he had shut me out of his life. And how it had happened in just the same way LeBay had died. Suddenly.
Yes, I said.
Arnie, I dream about the guy. You hear me talking to you? I dream about him. I'm going. We can go separately or together, but I'm going.
You weren't joking, were you?
Huh?
When you called me on the phone from that theater, you really didn't know he was dead?
Jesus Christ, you think I'd joke about something like that?
No,
he said, but not right away. He didn't say no until he'd thought it over carefully. He saw the possibility of all hands being turned against him now. Will Darnell had done that to him, and Buddy Repperton, and I suppose his mother and father, too. But it wasn't just them, or even principally them, because none of them was the first cause. It was the car.
You dream about him?
Yes. He stood there with his clean shirt in his hands, musing over that.
The paper said Libertyville Heights Cemetery, I said, finally. You gonna take the bus or ride with me?
I'll ride with you.
Good deal.
We stood on a hill above the graveside service, neither daring nor wanting to go down and join the handful of mourners. There were less than a dozen of them all told, half of them old guys in uniforms that looked old and carefully preserved. You could almost smell the mothballs. LeBay's casket was on runners over the grave. There was a flag on it. The preacher's words drifted up to us on a hot late August breeze. Man is like the grass which grows and then is cut down. Man is like a flower which blooms in the spring and fades in the summer. Man is in love and loves what passes. When the service ended, the flag was removed, and a man who looked to be in his 60s threw a handful of earth onto the coffin. Little particles trickled off and fell into the hole beneath. The obit had said he was survived by a brother and a sister. This had to be the brother. The resemblance wasn't overwhelming, but it was there. The sister evidently hadn't made it. There was no one but the boys down there around the hole in the ground. Two of the American Legion types folded the flag into a cocked hat, and one of them handed it to LeBay's brother. The preacher asked the Lord to bless them and keep them, to make his face shine upon them, to lift them up and give them peace. They started to drift away. I looked around for Arnie, and Arnie wasn't beside me anymore. He had gone a little distance away. He was standing under a tree. There were tears on his cheeks.
You okay, Arnie?
I asked. It occurred to me that I sure as hell hadn't seen any tears down there, and if Roland D. LeBay had known that Arnie Cunningham was going to be the only person to shed a tear for him at his small-time graveside ceremonies in one of western Pennsylvania's lesser-known boneyards, he might have knocked $50 off the price of his shitty car.
After all, Arnie still would have been paying 150 more than it was worth. He skidded the heels of his hands up the sides of his face in a gesture that was nearly savage. "Fine," he said hoarsely. "Come on."
"Sure." I thought he meant it was time to go, but he didn't start back toward where I'd parked my duster. He started down the hill instead. I started to ask him where he was going and then shut my mouth. I knew well enough. He wanted to talk to LeBay's brother. The brother was standing with two of the Legionnaire types, talking quietly, the flag under his arm. He was dressed in the suit of a man who is approaching retirement on a questionable income. It was a blue pinstripe with a slightly shiny seat. His tie was wrinkled at the bottom, and his white shirt had a yellowish tinge at the collar. He glanced around at us.
"Pardon me," Arnie said, "but you're Mr. LeBay's brother, aren't you?"
"Yes, I am." He looked at Arnie questioningly, and, I thought, a little warily. Arnie put out his hand.
"My name is Arnold Cunningham. I knew your brother slightly. I bought a car from him a short while ago."
When Arnie put his hand out, LeBay had automatically reached for it. With American men, the only gesture which may be more ingrained than the handshake response is checking your fly to make sure it's zipped after you come out of a public restroom. But when Arnie went on to say that he had bought a car from LeBay, the hand hesitated on its course. For a moment, I thought the man was not going to shake after all, that he would pull back and just leave Arnie's hand floating out there in the ozone. But he didn't do that, at least not quite. He gave Arnie's hand a single token squeeze and then dropped it.
"Christine," he said in a dry voice.
Yes, the family resemblance was there, in the way the brow shelved over the eyes, the set of the jaw, the light blue eyes. But this man's face was softer, almost kind. I did not think he was ever going to have the lean and vulpine aspects that had been Roland D. LeBay's.
"The last note I got from Raleigh said he'd sold her."
Good Christ. He was using that damned female pronoun, too. And Raleigh. It was hard to imagine LeBay, with his peeling skull and his pestiferous back brace, as anyone's Raleigh. But his brother had spoken the nickname in that same dry voice. There was no love in that voice. At least none that I could hear. LeBay went on.
"My brother didn't write often, but he had a tendency to gloat, Mr. Cunningham. I wish there was a gentler word for it, but I don't believe there is. In his note, Raleigh spoke of you as a sucker, and said he had given you what he called a royal screwing."
My mouth dropped open. I turned to Arnie, half expecting another outburst of rage, but his face hadn't changed at all.
"A royal screwing," he said mildly, "is always in the eye of the beholder. Don't you think so, Mr. LeBay?"
LeBay laughed, a little reluctantly, I thought.
"This is my friend. He was with me the day I bought the car."
I was introduced and shook George LeBay's hand. The soldiers had drifted away. The three of us, LeBay, Arnie, and I, were left eyeing one another uncomfortably. LeBay shifted his brother's flag from one hand to the other.
"Can I do something for you, Mr. Cunningham?"
LeBay asked at last. Arnie cleared his throat.
"I was wondering about the garage," he said finally. "You see, I'm working on the car, trying to get her street legal again. My folks don't want it at my house, and I was wondering..."
"No."
"If maybe I could rent the garage."
"No, out of the question. It's really..."
"I'd pay you $20 a week," Arnie said. "25 if you wanted."
I winced. He was like a kid who has stumbled into quicksand and decides to cheer himself up by eating a few arsenic-laced brownies. "Impossible." LeBay was looking more and more distressed.
"Just the garage," Arnie said, his calm starting to crack. "Just the garage where it originally was."
"It can't be done," LeBay said. "I listed the house with Century 21, Libertyville Realty, and Pittsburgh Homes just this morning. They'll be showing the house."
"Yes, sure, in time, but until..."
"And it wouldn't do to have you tinkering around. You see, don't you?" He bent toward Arnie a little. "Please don't misunderstand me.
I have nothing against teenagers in general. If I did, I'd probably be in a lunatic asylum now because I've taught high school in Paradise Falls, Ohio for almost 40 years, and you seem to be a very intelligent, well-spoken example of the genus adolescent, but all I want to do here in Libertyville is sell the house and split whatever proceeds there may be with my sister in Denver. I want to be shot of the house, Mr. Cunningham, and I want to be shot of my brother's life.
I see, Arnie said. Would it make any difference if I promised to look after the place? Mow the grass, repaint the trim, make little repairs? I can be handy that way.
He really is good at stuff like that, I chipped in. It wouldn't hurt, I thought, for Arnie to remember later that I had been on his side, even if I wasn't.
I've already hired a fella to keep an eye on the place and do a little maintenance, he said.
It sounded plausible, but I knew suddenly and surely that it was a lie. And I think Arnie knew it, too.
All right. I'm sorry about your brother. He seemed like a very strong-willed man.
As he said it, I found myself remembering turning around and seeing LeBay with large, greasy tears on his cheeks.
Well, that's that. I'm shut of her, sonny.
Strong-willed?
LeBay smiled cynically.
Oh, yes. He was a strong-willed son of a bitch.
He appeared not to notice Arnie's shocked expression.
Excuse me, gentlemen. I'm afraid the sun has upset my stomach a little.
He started to walk away. We stood not far from the grave and watched him go. All at once he stopped, and Arnie's face brightened. He thought LeBay had suddenly changed his mind. For a moment, LeBay just stood there on the grass, his head bent in the posture of a man thinking hard. Then he turned back to us.
My advice to you is to forget the car, he said to Arnie. Sell her. If no one will buy her whole, sell her for parts. If no one will buy her for parts, junk her. Do it quickly and completely. Do it the way you would quit a bad habit. I think you will be happier.
He stood there, looking at Arnie, waiting for Arnie to say something. But Arnie made no reply. He only held LeBay's gaze with his own. His eyes had gone that peculiar slaty color they got when his mind was made up and his feet were planted. LeBay read the look and nodded. He looked unhappy and a little ill.
Gentlemen, good day.
Arnie sighed.
I guess that's that.
He eyed LeBay's retreating back with some resentment.
Yeah,
I said, hoping I sounded more unhappy than I felt.
It was the dream. I didn't like the idea of Christine back in that garage. It was too much like my dream.
We started back toward my car, neither of us speaking. LeBay nagged at me. Both LeBays nagged at me. I came to a sudden, impulsive decision. God only knows how much different things might have been if I hadn't followed the impulse.
Hey, man, I said. I gotta take a whiz. Give me a minute or two, okay?
Sure, he said, hardly looking up. He walked on, hands in his pockets and eyes on the ground. I walked off to the left, where a small discreet sign and an even smaller arrow pointed the way toward the restrooms. But when I was over the first rise and out of Arnie's view, I cut to the right and started to sprint toward the parking lot. I caught George LeBay slowly folding himself behind the wheel of an extremely tiny Chevette with a Hertz sticker on the windshield.
Mr. LeBay, I puffed. Mr. LeBay?
He looked up curiously.
Pardon me, I said. Sorry to bother you again.
That's all right, he said. But I'm afraid what I said to your friend still stands. I can't let him garage the car there.
Good, I said.
His bushy eyebrows went up.
The car, I said. That Fury. I don't like it.
He went on looking at me, not talking.
I don't think it's been good for him. Maybe part of it's being, I don't know.
Jealous? He asked me quietly. Time he used to spend with you, he now spends with her?
Well, yeah, right, I said. He's been my friend for a long time, but I don't think that's all of it.
No?
No.
I looked around to see if Arnie was in sight, and while I wasn't looking at him, I was finally able to come out with it.
Why did you tell him to junk it and forget it?
Why did you say it was like a bad habit? He said nothing, and I was afraid he had nothing to say, at least not to me. And then, almost too softly to hear, he asked,
Son, are you sure this is your business?
I don't know. Suddenly it seemed very important to meet his eyes. But I care about Arnie, you know. I don't want to see him get hurt. This car has already gotten him in trouble. I don't want to see it get any worse.
Come by my motel this evening. It's just off the Western Avenue exit from 376. Can you find that?
I hot-patched the sides of the ramp, I said, and held out my hands. Still got the blisters.
I smiled, but he didn't smile back. Rainbow Motel. There are two at the foot of that exit. Mine is the cheap one.
Thanks, I said awkwardly. Listen, really,
It may not be your business, or mine, or anyone's, LeBay said in his soft, schoolteacherish voice, so different from, but somehow so eerily similar to, his late brother's wild croak.
And that's about the finest smell in the world, except maybe for pussy.
But I can tell you this much right now. My brother was not a good man. I believe the only thing he ever truly loved in his whole life was that Plymouth Fury your friend has purchased. So the business may be between them and them alone, no matter what you tell me or I tell you.
He smiled at me. It wasn't a pleasant smile, and in that instant I seemed to see Roland D. LeBay looking out through his eyes, and I shivered.
Son, you're probably too young to look for wisdom in anyone's words but your own, but I'll tell you this. Love is the enemy.
He nodded at me slowly.
Yes. The poets continually and sometimes willfully mistake love. Love is the old slaughterer. Love is not blind. Love is a cannibal with extremely acute vision. Love is insectile. It is always hungry.
What does it eat? I asked. Not aware I was going to ask anything at all. Every part of me but my mouth thought the entire conversation insane.
Friendship, George LeBay said. It eats friendship. If I were you, Dennis, I would now prepare for the worst.
He closed the door of the Chevette with a soft chuck and started up its sewing machine engine. He drove away, leaving me to stand there on the edge of the blacktop. I suddenly remembered that Arnie should see me coming from the direction of the comfort stations, so I headed that way as fast as I could. As I went, it occurred to me that the gravediggers, or sextons, or eternal engineers, or whatever they were calling themselves these days, would now be lowering LeBay's coffin into the earth. The dirt George LeBay had thrown at the end of the ceremony would be splattered across the top, like a conquering hand. I tried to dismiss the image, but another image, even worse, came in its place. Roland D. LeBay inside the silk-lined casket, dressed in his best suit and his best underwear, sans smelly, yellowing back brace, of course. LeBay was in the ground. LeBay was in his coffin, his hands crossed on his chest. And why was I so sure that a large, shit-eating grin was on his face?
Chapter 12. Some Family History. The Rainbow Motel was pretty bad, all right. It was one level high, the parking lot paving was cracked, two of the letters in the neon sign were out. It was exactly the sort of place you'd expect to find an elderly English teacher. I know how depressing that sounds, but it's true. And tomorrow he would turn in his Hertz car at the airport and fly home to Paradise Falls, Ohio. The Rainbow Motel looked like a geriatric ward. There were old parties sitting outside their rooms in the lawn chairs the management supplied for that purpose, their bony knees crossed, their white socks pulled up over their hairy shins. The men all looked like aging alpinists, skinny and tough. Most of the women were blooming with the soft fat of post-50 and no hope. Since then I've noticed that there are motels which seem filled up with nothing but people over 50. It's like they hear about these places on some oldies but goodies hotline. Bring your hysterectomy and enlarged prostate to the not-so-scenic Rainbow Motel. No cable TV, but we do have magic fingers, just a quarter a shot.
I saw no young people outside the units, and off to one side, the rusty playground equipment stood empty, the swings casting long, still shadows on the ground. Overhead, a neon rainbow arced over the sign. It buzzed like a swarm of flies caught in a bottle. LeBay was sitting outside Unit 14 with a glass in his hand. I went over and shook hands with him. "Would you like a soft drink?" he asked. "There's a machine in the office that dispenses them." "No, thanks," I said. I got one of the lawn chairs from in front of an empty unit and sat down beside him. "Then let me tell you what I can," he said in his soft, cultured voice. "I'm 11 years younger than Raleigh, and I'm still a man who is learning to be old." I shifted awkwardly in my chair and said nothing. "There were four of us," he said. "Raleigh was the oldest, I the youngest. Our brother Drew died in France in 1944. He and Raleigh were both career army. We grew up here, in Libertyville. Only Libertyville was much, much smaller then. You know, only a village. Small enough to have the ins and the outs. We were the outs. Poor folks. Shiftless. Wrong side of the tracks. Pick your cliché." He chuckled softly in the dusk and poured more 7-Up into his glass. "I really remember only one constant thing about Raleigh's childhood. After all, he was in the 5th grade when I was born. But I remember that one thing very well."
"What was it?"
"His anger," LeBay said. "Raleigh was always angry. He was angry that he had to go to school and cast off clothes. He was angry that our father was a drunkard who could not hold a steady job in any of the steel mills. He was angry that our mother could not make our father stop drinking. He was angry at the 3 smaller children, Drew, Marcia, and myself, who made the poverty insurmountable." He held out his arm to me and pushed up the sleeve of his shirt to show me the withered, corded tendons of his old man's arm, which lay just below the surface of the shiny, stretched skin. A scar skidded from his elbow toward his wrist, where it finally petered out. "That was a present from Raleigh," he said. "I got it when I was 3 and he was 14. I was playing with a few painted blocks of wood that were supposed to be cars and trucks on the front walk when he slammed out on his way to school. I was in his way, I suppose. He pushed me, went onto the sidewalk, and then he came back and threw me. I landed with my arm stuck on one of the pickets of the fence that went around the bunch of weeds and sunflowers that my mother insisted on calling the garden. I bled enough to scare all of them into tears, all of them except Raleigh, who just kept shouting, 'You stay out of my way from now on, you goddamn snot-nose! Stay out of my way, you hear?'" I looked at the old scar, fascinated, realizing that it looked like a skid because that small, chubby 3-year-old's arm had grown over the course of years into the skinny, shiny old man's arm I was now looking at. A wound that had been an ugly gouge spilling blood everywhere in the year 1921 had slowly elongated into this silvery progression of marks like ladder rungs. The wound had closed, but the scar had spread. A terrible, hopeless shudder twisted through me. I thought of Arnie slamming his fist down on the dashboard of my car, Arnie crying hoarsely that he would make them eat it, eat it, eat it. George LeBay was looking at me. I don't know what he saw in my face, but he slowly rolled his sleeve back down, and when he buttoned it securely over that scar, it was as if he had drawn the curtain on an almost unbearable past. He sipped more 7-Up. "My father came home that evening. He had been on one of the toots that he called hunting up a job, and when he heard what Raleigh had done, he wailed the tar out of him. But Raleigh would not recant. He cried, but he would not recant." LeBay smiled a little. "At the end, my mother was terrified, screaming for my father to stop before he killed him. The tears were rolling down Raleigh's face, and still he would not recant. 'He was in my way,' Raleigh said through his tears. 'And if he gets in my way again, I'll do it again, and you can't stop me, you damned old tosspot.' Then my father struck him in the face and made his nose bleed, and Raleigh fell on the floor with the blood squirting through his fingers. My mother was screaming, Marcia was crying, Drew was cringing in one corner, and I was bawling my head off, holding my bandaged arm. And Raleigh went right on saying, "I do it again, you tosspot, tosspot, damned old tosspot."
Above us, the stars had begun to come out. An old woman left a unit down the way, took a battered suitcase out of a Ford, and carried it back into her unit. Somewhere, a radio was playing. It was not tuned to the rock sounds of FM 104.
"His unending fury is what I remember best," LeBay repeated softly. "At school, he fought with anyone who made fun of his clothes or the way his hair was cut. He would fight anyone he even suspected of making fun. He was suspended again and again. Finally, he left and joined the army."
It wasn't a good time to be in the army, the 20s. There was no dignity, no promotion, no flying flags and banners. There was no nobility. He went from base to base, first in the South and then in the Southwest. We got a letter every 3 months or so. He was still angry. He was angry at what he called the shitters. Everything was the fault of the shitters. The shitters wouldn't give him the promotion he deserved. The shitters had canceled a furlough. The shitters couldn't find their own behinds with both hands and a flashlight. On at least two occasions, the shitters put him in the stockade. The army held on to him because he was an excellent mechanic. He could keep the old and decrepit vehicles, which were all Congress would allow the army, in some sort of running condition. Uneasily, I found myself thinking of Arnie again, Arnie, who was so clever with his hands. LeBay leaned forward. "But that talent was just another wellspring for his anger, young man. And it was an anger that never ended until he bought that car that your friend now owns."
"What do you mean?"
LeBay chuckled dryly.
"He fixed Army convoy trucks, Army staff cars, Army weapons supply vehicles. He fixed bulldozers and kept staff cars running with spit and baling wire. And once, when a visiting congressman came to visit Fort Arnold in West Texas and had car trouble, he was ordered by his commanding officer, who was desperate to make a good impression, to fix the congressman's prized Bentley. Oh, yes, we got a 4-page letter for that particular shitter. A 4-page rant of Raleigh's anger and vitriol. It was a wonder the words didn't smoke on the page. All those vehicles. But Raleigh never owned a car himself until after World War II. Even then, the only thing he was able to afford was an old Chevrolet that ran poorly and was eaten up with rust. In the 20s and 30s, there was never money enough, and during the war years, he was too busy trying to stay alive. He was in the motor pool for all those years, and he fixed thousands of vehicles for the shitters and never had one that was all his. It was Libertyville all over again. Even the old Chevrolet couldn't assuage that, or the old Hudson Hornet he bought used the year after he got married."
"Married?"
"Didn't tell you that, did he?" LeBay said. "He would have been happy to go on and on about his army experiences, his war experiences, and his endless confrontations with the shitters, for as long as you and your friend could listen without falling asleep, and him with his hand in your pocket, feeling for your wallet the whole time. But he wouldn't have bothered to tell you about Veronica or Rita."
"Who were they?"
"Veronica was his wife," LeBay said. "They were married in 1951, shortly before Raleigh went to Korea. He could have stayed stateside, you know. He was married, his wife was pregnant, he himself was approaching middle age. But he chose to go." LeBay looked reflectively at the dead playground equipment. "It was bigamy, you know. By 1951, he was 44, and he was married already. He was married to the army, and to the shitters." He fell silent again. His silence had a morbid quality.
"Are you all right?"
I asked finally. "Yes," he said. "Just thinking. Thinking ill of the dead." He looked at me calmly, except for his eyes. They were dark and wounded.
"You know, all of this hurts me, young man.
What did you say your name was?"
"I don't want to sit here and sing these old sad songs to someone I can't call by his first name. Was it Donald?"
"Dennis," I said.
"Look, Mr. LeBay..." "It hurts more than I would have suspected," he went on. "But now that it's begun, let's finish it, shall we? I only met Veronica twice. She was from West Virginia, near Wheeling. She was what we then called shirt-tail Southern, and she was not terribly bright. Raleigh was able to dominate her and take her for granted, which was what he seemed to want. But she loved him, I think, at least until the rotten business with Rita. As for Raleigh, I don't think he really married a woman at all. He married a kind of wailing wall. The letters that he sent us... Well, you must remember that he left school very early. The letters, illiterate as they were, represented a tremendous effort for my brother. They were his suspension bridge, his novel, his symphony, his great effort. I don't think he wrote them to get rid of the poison in his heart. I think he wrote them to spread it around. Once he had Veronica, the letters stopped. He had his set of eternal ears, and he didn't have to bother with us anymore. I suppose he wrote letters to her during the 2 years he was in Korea. I only got one during that period, and I believe Marcia got two. There was no pleasure over the birth of his daughter in early 1952, only a surly complaint that there was another mouth to feed at home, and the shitters took a little more out of him. "Did he never advance in rank?" I asked. The year before, I had seen part of a long TV show, one of those novels for television called Once an Eagle. I had seen the paperback book in the drugstore the next day and had picked it up, hoping for a good war story. As it turned out, I got both war and peace, and some new ideas about the armed services. One of them was that the old promotion train really gets rolling along in times of war. It was hard for me to understand how LeBay could have gone into the service in the early 20s, slogged through 2 wars, and still have been running junk when Ike became president. LeBay laughed. He was like Pruitt in From Here to Eternity. He would advance, and then he would be busted back down for something. Insubordination, or impertinence, or drunkenness. I told you he had spent time in the stockade. One of those times was for pissing in the punch bowl at the officers' club at Fort Dix before a party. He only did 10 days for that offense because I believe they must have looked into their own hearts and believed it was nothing more than a drunken joke, such as some of the officers themselves had probably played as fraternity boys. They didn't, they couldn't, have any idea of the hate and deadly loathing that lay behind that gesture. But I imagine that by then, Veronica could have told them. I glanced at my watch. It was 9:15. LeBay had been talking for nearly an hour. My brother came home from Korea in 1953... to meet his daughter for the first time. I understand he looked her over for a minute or two, then handed her back to his wife, and went out to tinker on his old Chevrolet for the rest of the day. Getting bored, Dennis? No, I said truthfully. All through those years, the one thing that Raleigh really wanted was a brand new car. Not a Cadillac or a Lincoln. He didn't want to join the upper class, the officers, the shitters. He wanted a new Plymouth, or maybe a Ford or a Dodge. Veronica wrote now and then, and she said that they spent most of their Sundays going around to car dealerships, wherever Raleigh was currently stationed. She and the baby would sit in the old Hornet Raleigh had then, and Veronica would read little storybooks to Rita, while Raleigh walked around dusty lot after dusty lot with salesman after salesman, talking about compression and horsepower and hemi heads and gear ratios. I think sometimes of the little girl growing up to the background sound of those plastic pennants whipping in the hot wind of 6 army tank towns, and I don't know whether to laugh or cry. My thoughts turned back to Arnie again. Was he... obsessed, would you say? Yes. I would say he was obsessed. He began to give Veronica money to put away. Other than his failure to get promoted past Master Sergeant at any point in his career, my brother had a problem with drink. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he went on periodic binges every 6 or 8 months. What money he had would be gone when the binge was over. He was never sure where he spent it. Veronica was supposed to put a stop to that. It was one of the things he married her for. When the binges started, Raleigh would come to her for the money. He threatened her with a knife once, held it to her throat. I got this from my sister, who sometimes talked to Veronica on the telephone.
Veronica would not give him the money, which at that time, in 1955, totaled about $800. "Remember the car, honey," she told him, with the point of his knife on her throat. "You'll never get that new car if and you booze the money away."
"She must have loved him," I said.
"Well, maybe she did. But please don't make the romantic assumption that her love changed Raleigh in any way. Water can wear away stone, but only over hundreds of years. People are mortal." He seemed to debate saying something else along that line and then to decide against it. The lapse struck me as peculiar. "But he never put a mark on either of them," he said. "And you must remember that he was drunk on the occasion when he held the knife to her throat. There is a great outcry about drugs in the schools now, and I don't oppose that outcry because I think it's obscene to think of children 15 and 16 years old reeling around full of dope. But I still believe alcohol is the most vulgar, dangerous drug ever invented. And it is legal." When my brother finally left the army in 1957, Veronica had put away a little over $1,200. Adding to it was a substantial disability pension for his back injury. He fought the shitters for it and won, he said. So the money was finally there. They got the house you and your friend visited, but before the house was even considered, of course, the car came. The car was always paramount. The visits to the car dealerships reached a fever pitch, and at last he settled upon Christine. I got a long letter about her. She was a 1958 Fury Sport Coupe, and he gave me all the facts and figures in his letter. I don't remember them, but I bet your friend could cite her vital statistics chapter and verse.
"Her measurements," I said.
LeVay smiled humorlessly.
"Her measurements, yes.
I do remember that he wrote her sticker price was just a tad under 3,000, but he Jewed 'em down, as he put it, to 2,100 with the trade-in. He ordered her, paid 10% down, and when she came in, he paid the balance in cash, $10 and $20 bills. The next year, Rita, who was then 6, choked to death. I jumped in my chair and almost knocked it over. His soft, teacherish voice had a lulling quality, and I was tired. I had been half asleep. That last had been like a dash of cold water in my face. "Yes, that's right," he said to my questioning, startled glance. They had been out motorvating for the day. That was what replaced the car-hunting expeditions. Motorvating, that was his word for it. He got that from one of those rock and roll songs he was always listening to. Every Sunday the three of them would go out motorvating. There were litter bags in the front and the back. The little girl was forbidden to drop anything on the floor. She was forbidden to make any messes. She knew that lesson well. He fell into that peculiar thinking silence again, and then came back on a new tack. Raleigh kept the ashtrays clean. Always. He was a heavy smoker, but he'd poke his cigarette out the wing window instead of tapping it into the ashtray. And when he was done with the cigarette, he'd snuff it and toss it out the window. If he had someone with him who did use the ashtray, he'd dump the ashtray and then wipe it out with a paper towel when the drive was over. He washed her twice a week and simonized her twice a year. He serviced her himself, buying time at a local garage. I wondered if it had been Darnell's. On that particular Sunday, they stopped at a roadside stand for hamburgers on the way home. There were no McDonald's in those days, you know, just roadside stands. And what happened was simple enough, I suppose. That silence again, as if he wondered just how much he should tell me, or how to separate what he knew from his speculations.
"She choked to death on a piece of meat," he said finally. "When she started to gag and put her hands to her throat, Raleigh pulled over, dragged her out of the car, and thudded her on the back, trying to bring it up. Of course, now they have a method, the Heimlich maneuver, that works rather well in situations like that. A young girl, a student teacher, actually saved a boy who was choking in the cafeteria at my school just last year by employing the Heimlich maneuver. But in those days,
My niece died by the side of the road. I imagine it was a filthy, frightening way to die. His voice had resumed that sleepy schoolroom cadence, but I no longer felt sleepy. Not at all. He tried to save her, I believe that, and I try to believe that it was only ill luck that she died. He had been in a ruthless business for a long time, and I don't believe he loved his daughter very deeply, if at all. But sometimes, in mortal matters, a lack of love can be a saving grace. Sometimes ruthlessness is what is required. But not this time, I said. In the end, he turned her over and held her by her ankles. He punched her in the belly, hoping to make her vomit. I believe he would have tried to do a tracheotomy on her with his pocket knife if he had even the slightest idea of how to go about it. But of course, he did not. She died. Marcia and her husband and family came to the funeral. So did I. It was our last family reunion. I remember thinking, he will have traded the car, of course. In an odd way, I was a little disappointed. It had figured so largely in Veronica's letters, and the few which Raleigh wrote, that I felt it was almost a member of their family. But he hadn't. They pulled up to the Libertyville Methodist Church in it, and it was polished, and shining, and hateful. It was hateful. He turned to look at me. Do you believe that, Dennis? I had to swallow before I could answer. Yes, I said. I believe it. LeBay nodded grimly. Veronica was sitting in the passenger seat like a wax dummy. Whatever she had been, whatever there was inside her, was gone. Raleigh had had the car. She had had the daughter. She didn't just grieve, she died. I sat there and tried to imagine it, tried to imagine what I would have done if it had been me. My daughter starts to choke and strangle in the back seat of my car and then dies by the side of the road. Would I trade the car away? Why, it wasn't the car that killed her. It was whatever she strangled on, the bit of hamburger and bun that had blocked her windpipe. So why trade the car? Other than the small fact that I wouldn't even be able to look at it. Wouldn't even be able to think of it without horror and sorrow. Would I trade it? Man, there's a bear shit in the woods. Did you ask him about it? I asked him, all right. Marcia was with me. It was after the service. Veronica's brother had come up from Glory, West Virginia, and he took her back to the house after the graveside ceremony. She was in a kind of walking swoon anyway. We got him alone, Marcia and I. That was the real reunion. I asked him if he intended to trade the car. It was parked directly behind the hearse that had brought his daughter to the cemetery. The same cemetery where Raleigh himself was buried today, you know. It was red and white. Chrysler never offered the 1958 Plymouth Fury in those colors. Raleigh had gotten it custom painted. We were standing about 50 feet away from it, and I had the strangest feeling, the strangest urge, to move yet farther away, as if it could hear us. What did you say? I asked him if he was going to trade the car. That hard, mulish look came into his face, that look I remembered so well from my early childhood. It was the look that had been on his face when he threw me onto the picket fence, the look that was on his face when he kept calling my father a tosspot, even after my father made his nose bleed. He said, I'd be crazy to trade her, George. She's only a year old, and she's only got 11,000 miles on her. You know you never get your money out of a trade until a car's 3 years old. I said, if this is a matter of money to you, Raleigh, someone stole what was left of your heart and replaced it with a piece of stone. Do you want your wife looking at it every day, riding in it? Good God, man! That look never changed. Not until he looked at the car, sitting there in the sunlight, sitting there behind the hearse. That was the only time his face softened. I remember wondering if he'd ever looked at Rita that way. I don't suppose he ever did. I don't think it was in him. He fell silent for a moment, and then went on. Marcia told him all the same things. She was always afraid of Raleigh, but that day she was more mad than afraid. She had gotten Veronica's letters, remember, and she knew how much Veronica loved her little girl. She told him that when someone dies, you burn the mattress they slept on, you give their clothes to the Salvation Army, whatever, you put finish to the life any way you can so that the living can get on with their business. She told him that his wife was never going to be able to get on with her business as long as the car where her daughter died was still in the garage. Raleigh asked her in that ugly, sarcastic way he had if she wanted him to douse his car with gasoline and touch a match to her just because his daughter had choked to death. My sister started to cry and told him she thought that was a fine idea. Finally, I took her by the arm and led her away. There was no talking to Raleigh then or ever. The car was his, and he could talk on and on about keeping a car 3 years before you trade it, and he could talk about mileage until he was blue in the face, but the simple fact was, he was going to keep her because he wanted to keep her. Marcia and her family went back to Denver on a Greyhound, and so far as I know, she never saw Raleigh again, or even wrote him a note. She didn't come to Veronica's funeral. His wife. First the kid, and then the wife. I knew somehow that it had been just like that. Bang, bang. The kind of numbness crept up my legs to the pit of my stomach. She died 6 months later, in January of 1959. But nothing to do with the car, I said. Nothing to do with the car, right? It had everything to do with the car, he said softly. I don't want to hear it, I thought. But of course, I would hear it. Because my friend owned that car now, and because it had become something that had grown out of all proportion to what it should have been in his life. After Rita died, Veronica went into a depression. She simply never came out of it. She had made some friends in Libertyville, and they tried to help her. Help her find her way again, I guess one would say. But she was not able to find her way. Not at all. Otherwise, things were fine. For the first time in my brother's life, there was plenty of money. He had his army pension, his disability pension, and he had gotten a job as a night watchman at the tire factory over on the west side of town. I drove over there after the funeral, but it's gone. It went broke 12 years ago, I said. I was just a kid. There's a Chinese fast food place there now. They were paying off the mortgage at the rate of 2 payments a month, and, of course, they had no little girl to take care of any longer. But for Veronica, there was never any light or impulse toward recovery. She went about committing suicide quite cold-bloodedly, from all that I've been able to find out. If there were textbooks for aspiring suicides, her own might be included as an example to emulate. She went down to the Western Auto Store here in town, the same one where I got my first bicycle many, many years ago, and bought 20 feet of rubber hose. She fitted one end over Christine's exhaust pipe and put the other end in one of the back windows. She had never gotten a driver's license, but she knew how to start a car. That was really all she needed to know. I pursed my lips, wet them with my tongue, and heard my voice little more than a rusty croak. I think I'll get that soda now. Perhaps you'd be good enough to get me another, he said. It will keep me awake, they always do. But I suspect I'd be awake most of tonight anyway. I suspect that I would be, too. I went to get the sodas in the motel office, and on my way back I stopped halfway across the parking lot. He was only a deeper shadow in front of his motel unit, his white socks glimmering like small ghosts. I thought, maybe the car is cursed. Maybe that's what it is. It sounds like a ghost story, all right. There's a signpost up ahead. Next stop, the Twilight Zone. But that was ridiculous.
wasn't it?
Of course it was. I went on walking again. Cars didn't carry curses any more than people carried them. That was horror movie stuff, sort of amusing for a Saturday night at the drive-in, but very, very far from the day-to-day facts that make up reality. I gave him his can of soda and heard the rest of his story, which could be summed up in one line. He lived unhappily ever after. The one and only Roland D. LeBay had kept his small tract house, and he had kept his 1958 Plymouth. In 1965, he had hung up his night watchman's cap and his check-in clock, and somewhere around the same time, he had stopped his painstaking efforts to keep Christine looking and running like new. He had let her run down the way a man might let a watch run down.
"You mean it just sat out there?" I asked. "Since 1965, for 13 years?
"No, he put it in the garage, of course," LeBay said. "The neighbors would never have stood for a car just moldering away out on someone's lawn. In the country, maybe, but not in suburbia, USA.
"But it was out there when we..."
"Yes, I know. He put it out on the lawn with a for sale sign in the window. I asked about that. I was curious, and so I asked at the Legion. Most of them had lost touch with Raleigh, but one of them said he thought he'd seen the car out there on the lawn for the first time this May."
I started to say something and then fell silent.
A terrible idea had come to me, and that idea was simply this. It was too convenient. Much too convenient. Christine had sat in that dark garage for years, 4, 8, a dozen more, then a few months before Arnie and I came along and Arnie saw it. Roland LeBay had suddenly hauled it out and stuck a for sale sign on it. Later on, much later, I checked back through issues of the Pittsburgh papers and the Libertyville paper, the Keystone. He had never advertised the Fury, at least not in the papers, where you usually hawk a car that you want to sell. He just put it out on his suburban street, not even a thoroughfare, and waited for a buyer to come along. I did not completely realize the rest of the thought then, not in any logical, intellectual way at least, but I had enough of it to feel a recurrence of that cold, blue feeling of fright. It was as if he knew a buyer would be coming, if not in May, then in June, or July, or August. Sometime soon. No, I didn't get this idea logically or rationally. What came instead was a wholly visceral image. A Venus flytrap at the edge of a swamp, its green jaws wide open, waiting for an insect to land. The right insect.
I remember thinking he must have given it up because he didn't want to take a chance of flunking the driver's exam, I said, finally. After you get so old, they make you take one every year or two. The renewal stops being automatic.
George LeBay nodded.
"That sounds like Raleigh," he said. "But..."
"But what?"
"I remember reading somewhere, and I can't remember who said it or wrote it for the life of me, that there are times in human existence. That when it came to be steam engine time, a dozen men invented steam engines. Maybe only one man got the patent or the credit in the history books, but all at once, there they were. All those people working on that one idea. How do you explain it? Just that it's steam engine time." LeBay took a drink of his soda and looked up at the sky. "Comes the Civil War, and all at once it's ironclad time. Then it's machine gun time. Next thing you know, it's electricity time, and wireless time, and finally it's atom bomb time. As if those ideas all come not from individuals, but from some great wave of intelligence that always keeps flowing. Some wave of intelligence that is outside of humanity." He looked at me. "That idea scares me if I think about it too much, Dennis. There seems to be something, well, decidedly unchristian about it."
"And for your brother, there was sell Christine time?"
"Perhaps. Ecclesiastes says there's a season for everything. A time to sow, a time to reap, a time for war, a time for peace, a time to put away the sling, and a time to gather stones together.
a negative for every positive. So if there was a Christine time in Raleigh's life, there might have come a time for him to put Christine away as well. If so, he would have known it. He was an animal, and animals listen very well to their instincts. Or maybe he finally just tired of it, LeBay finished. I nodded that that might be it, mostly because I was anxious to be gone, not because that explained it to my complete satisfaction. George LeBay hadn't seen that car on the day Arnie had yelled at me to go back. I had seen it, though. The 58 hadn't looked like a car that had been resting peacefully in a garage. It had been dirty and dented, the windshield cracked, one bumper mostly torn away. It had looked like a corpse that had been disinterred and left to decay in the sun. I thought of Veronica LeBay and shivered. As if reading my thoughts, part of them anyway, LeBay said, I know very little about